At odds with his father, Tom had left home as a boy, and now his parents were dead, he drifted like the twigs and leaves on the river.
I've never done anything like this before, so I don't know how I'll do at it, but I suppose reading things into a microphone, I should be able to do that.
And you got out of the car, pulled down the fly and pistol over the roses. This is on a Sunday afternoon. It's a beautiful summer Sunday afternoon. That was the end of that whole call. We just thought it was brilliant after that. Really.
This is Anne Enright's voice, all right. Wry, disabused, reckless, candid and funny. It's a huge pleasure to welcome to the stage Anne Enright.
You are listening to Red Line Readings, which was recorded live at Civic Theatre Tala as part of South Dublin Library's Red Line Book Festival. On this programme, you will hear Dermot Bulger in conversation with Christine Dwyer Hickey. We are joining Dermot at the Civic Theatre as he introduces Christine to the audience. Red Line Readings was made with the support of Sound and Vision, a Broadcasting Authority of Ireland fund.
It's a huge pleasure to welcome on stage. We have the great Christine Dwyer Hickey. Christine, are you there? How are you, Pat?
I'm grand. How are you?
Do you want to give us a reading from the book? And then,
I'll read from my old battered version first. How many minutes do you want me to read?
Oh, around 4 hours, 52.
4 hours, grand. No, we'll start at the beginning.
15 will be about perfect.
10 minutes, all right. Okay. Anyway, this is an extract from The Cold Eye of Heaven. It's a story about, it's a life told backwards. And it begins in 2010 when the character Farley is 75 years of age. The second chapter is day before, and after that, every chapter goes back 10 years. So he's 75 for the first and second chapter, then 65, 55, 45, and so on, until he's a baby and dying again. It goes full anti-clockwise circle. So the section that I've picked is the day before he dies. He doesn't know this, of course. We know it. He has to go into town to do a few messages, as they used to say, preparing for the funeral of a former friend and colleague, somebody he worked with for 40 years. And he has to get ready for this funeral by getting... He's just left a suit into the cleaners. He's to get the shoes soled, new sole put on the shoe in case he has to go up to the altar, which he's in two minds about. And he has to get a mass card signed. So this is kind of a flavour. It's just after a big snow and he's been housebound for a few days. He's not feeling very well. But it's kind of just a flavour of what it's like to be that age in Dublin now and to be, you know, always a little bit afraid when you weren't used to being so in your earlier days. The bus is jammers. He's sitting upstairs as he always does because he likes looking down on other people's gardens, giving them marks out of 10 for appearance. He's sitting upstairs in the solid, stuffy air, the windows fogged with the breath of strangers and some little box down the back smoking a cigarette. But who's going to say a word to him? One vacant seat on the right, two-thirds of the way down. Farley goes to it, then settles himself in by the window. Cleary's bag on his lap, the shape of the shoe inside it, the corner of the mass card, everything in order. Grand. Around him, people are talking into mobile phones. Mobile phones are beeping at people. One girl roaring at the top of her voice. So I just said to him, yeah, is that right, is it? Because you can fucking think I'm putting up with that. You can go and fuck right off, you and your scabby bleeding owl one. Farley tries to remember when this started to happen. People shouting on the bus, letting everyone know their business, turning their minds inside out, broadcasting every thought in their heads. Near the front of the bus, two large African women, startlingly dressed, sit across the aisle from each other. As they speak, huge hats like big paper bags plonked on top of their heads nod softly to each other, flax yellow to scarlet red. That's how it should be. A quiet conversation. A little bit shy, a little bit open. Let people eavesdrop because they want to and not because they have no choice. He stretches up to open a window, glancing around as he does so, as if he should be asking for someone's permission. A squirt of clean, sharp air quenches his face. The woman sitting in front runs her hand over the back of her neck, gives a little shudder and toots. Farley pretends not to notice. He sits down again, rubs the viewing screen into the steam on the window and looks out. He wants the bus to slow down a bit so he can look at the gardens. But the bus, too full to stop, is barreling along. All he can see is rows of houses jigging loosely by like old-fashioned freight trains, flat green, dirty white, brown. In the seat just behind him, a man and a woman are talking, voices pitched secretively low. "Look at them, just look at them," the woman is saying. "Make you sick, it would. There must be a shipment in or something. I mean, you can just feel the buzz in the air. Make you sick, they would." And that's when it comes to him, the pension. Did he collect it or not? He just can't remember. He has an image of himself standing in the post office queue, surrounded by people lumpy in winter clothes, shuffling one by one to the top. He has a memory of the recurrent thump of a rubber stamp. And he can remember, too, turning around to see a woman fresh in from the cold going, "Oh, Jesus, I'm blinded," as her glasses clouded up from the sudden heat. But he doesn't know, is that today or another winter's day? Last week, the week before, years ago even. He takes off his gloves and puts them in the Cleary's bag, then slips his hand into his inside pocket. He can feel the pension book there, the wallet stuck in behind it. At least he wasn't dipped. At least that much. He's getting ready to pull them out to have a look when he hears the pair behind him at it again. She says, "Scumbags is all they are. Look at them. Rob the hair out of your head for a hit, they would." Farley looks around and sees what she means. Junkies all over the bus. Better wait till he's somewhere safe before he goes opening his wallet. There's one squirming in a seat across the way, another one with a twitchy face further down the aisle. Two more of them are whinging to each other with their underdog eyes like everyone else is to blame for their great misfortune. Ghosts, that's what they're like. Ghosts in purgatory. He feels nervous now, worse than nervous, afraid of being on this bus full of ghosts. He has the sense that if he doesn't get off quick, he might not get off at all. That he'd snuff it here on this very seat. He raises himself, begins to gather his bag and gloves. Then he sees a woman's head appearing at the top of the stairwell. A big heap rising slow and full like a genie coming out of a bottle. He sees her eyes wandering down the aisle and stop at the space beside him. Farley sits back. It's all right. It's all right. Everything is going to be all right. Hasn't his headache gone? His eyesight clear? Hasn't he enough money left over from last week's pension thanks to the snow and no opportunity to spend it? Enough to keep him going till tomorrow, because that's when he'll really need it. Everything is grand, no headache, clear vision, money in wallet, and a big fat woman squeezing down the aisle towards the seat to protect him from all the ghosts. He flattens himself in against the window. Farley gets off in Westmoreland Street, dank, cold and greasy. Junkies to the left and right of him, slithering off the bus, slipping around corners, melting into the inner shadows of this already shadowy street. The clash and wallop of noise, Irish-flavoured music from gaudy interiors. Buses wheezing and squawking like wounded animals, motor cars. His head starts hopping again. Two foreign gypsies, long skirts and shawls, come sidling up to him, whimpering a begging prayer. A long, thin hand comes out of a doorway asking for change. Another gypsy is changing a child's nappy on the step of an office. She folds it over and just there on the ground before hauling the child back up on her hip and moving away. He reaches the corner where yet another junkie, hood pulled over his head, is whining into a mobile phone. Farley stands a few feet away from him. From the side of the hood, an eye surveys him. Farley moves further away. 20 years ago, he'd have planted the bastard. 10 years ago, he might even have tried. He puts his head down and keeps his walk brisk until in a step that passes from shadow to light, he finds himself in the centre of the bridge. The sky clear and broad, the river air cold and sweet, the light sitting on water like cut glass. The ghosts all departed now. Farley sighs through his teeth and squares back his shoulders. Stronger now, renewed, he has walked through his fear. He's all right. He finds himself turning onto the quays, retracing the steps he would have taken every day from the office to the forecourts, 40 years worth. That's a lot of steps, a lot of miles. When he started, he could do it in 8 minutes flat. The week he retired, it took 10. What would it be now? Not fair to challenge himself on a day like today, he decides, with the ground so uncertain and him not feeling the best. Next time, maybe then. He stands for a moment on the first of the four granite steps, the railings, the door, the windows at the side, all the same. The brass plate is gone, leaving a bald square patch surrounded by dirtier brick. The company name is still etched in gold leaf on the ground floor and first floor windows. He remembers the day it was painted, the office not long opened. A lad from the West slowly explaining the process and fairly torn between watching the liquid gold unfurl on the glass and attending to the screaming chorus of black phones behind him. Later that evening they had come out onto the street to admire it. The painter, Frank Slowey, himself, Brophy, that little blondie one who used to do the secretarial. They had crossed the road to stand at the quay wall, a warm dusky evening, the hum from the river. Slowey in shirt sleeves, the girl with her frock stuck to her legs. Now, Slowey had said, nodding his approval. Now, what do you all think of that? His voice had been shaky, and for a minute Farley had thought he'd seen tears, actual tears in his eyes. But then Slowey had turned around and started messing, poking them on the arm, slapping them on the back of the head, lifting the young one up and swinging her around, her screaming like a seagull, while at the same time trying to hold down the hem of her dress. Ah, Mr. Slowey, Jesus, Mr. Slowey, will you stop it? Farley looks up and over the windows. The house appears to be empty now. In his time, he'd seen every room of it occupied over and over, a mixed bag of oddballs through the years. A struck-off solicitor knows the shape of a little red arse sniffing around for a few crumbs. The tailor, of course, the dress hire woman. And there was an architect that only came in for an hour a day, sandwiches tucked under his jumper like he was ashamed of them. A dodgy enterpriser too, usually called something with the word export in the title. Farley climbs the steps and stands at the door. There's a planning permission sign on the wall beside it. He's leaning in to read it when the door jumps open, frightening the life out of him. A man standing there. All right, he asks. Yeah, I'm grand, ha. I used to work here, you see, and for years I did. I worked here. The man has a bunch of letters in his hand, holding the door back with his foot while he racks through them. Behind him, the hall is dark as a cave. The same lino on the floor, old letters in a box on a table. Were you looking for anyone in particular? He asks. Unless myself, Farley says, then turns and comes back down the steps. The cold shudders through him. Tea. He was supposed to be getting a cup of tea. Now in a shopping centre, blast of white light, a screeching baby. Too late he remembers the mass card after passing right by the church on the quays. Other churches pop up and down in his head. Marlborough Street, Whitefriars, John's, Adams and Eve. Churches from all over the city. All very well, but which is the nearest, because he hasn't a clue where he is now. One shopping centre bleeding into another. Lights, glass, bawling children. He needs a little rest, a sup of tea, sugar, maybe a bun and a newspaper to hide behind. He could check on the death notice, make sure Frank Slowey really is dead. He looks for a cafe, but all he can see is a place with no front wall opening directly out onto the aisle of the shopping centre. Plastic tables, plastic trays, paper mugs of tea that you have to go up and get yourself and then stand like a tick looking around till you see a table and then climb over yourself to get to it so you can drink your tea from your paper cup while the world goes by and gawks in at you sitting there in your plastic grotto. It doesn't even look as if there's a Jack's in there and he'd be looking to have a soon enough. Is it too much to ask? A bit of comfort? Someone to serve him? Maybe say a few words? Solid things all around his hands, like cup and a saucer, a stainless steel pot, milk in a jug, handles to hold on to. Is that too much? The light starts beating again, his head. A long skewer pierces through, then pulls out again. There's a rush of pinpricks in his arm, a smaller one in his face. More unpleasant than painful, peculiar. It lasts a few seconds, then all clear again. He keeps losing moments. It's like they're falling out of a hole in his pocket. The Cleary's bag is back under his arm, the shape of a shoe through its skin. He pulls the shoe out. An unblemished surface of a new blank sole looks up at him, lightly tan in colour, a perfect archway of minute and pristine nails. Yet he can't for the life of him remember collecting it. Was the girl in the red coat outside the pub then or before? Were the taxi men eyeing him hungrily? Did someone ask him if he was all right? And when did he remember that Jackie was his brother? And now here he is, standing in the island in O'Connell Street, looking up at the glint of a giant needle that used to be Nelson's pillar, and thinking about the junkies again, and trying to pull the two ends of the same idea together, the junkies and the giant needle, and staring up at the needle and imagining himself on the bus, the wall of the Phoenix Park on one side, the scrag end of the Liffey on the other. And the next thing is he is on the bus and crossing the river to turn into Parkgate Street, wondering how he got from staring up at the needle to here. Splinters of light in his eyes again, and a huge cruise ship rises before him. It takes a moment to grasp it. That's right, the new criminal court's building. A big belly full of glass, the falling sun spitting all over it, barristers outside flapping like crows on its steps.
Christine, this book is a magnificent book. It's a magnificent portrait of a very ordinary Dubliner. And that sense of old age, because my own father, in his final years, you feel beginning to, gaps beginning to come in the imagination between, yeah. Between reality and between time. But also a brilliant portrait of the city as well. And it's almost as if your career has three sort of careers, in the sense that the first books came out and weren't not much noticed. And yeah. Then with Tatty, there was a second career almost, and yeah. Those books came back into being again.
Yeah.
And now, the last few years, these new books have actually suddenly gone out and reached a big international market and sort of... And also, as the career expanded, your imagination has expanded in some ways, and the different locations and the different settings and the different... Also, you slip very easily between decades. And between writing about different periods as well, you know?
Yeah, I suppose I do. I don't think my imagination is any different than it was.
Yeah.
But it's just that it got probably more notice. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question, if it isn't even a question. I mean, I just write the books and sometimes I come out this way.
Is it easier to write about somebody like Farley than about somebody who's like yourself, in the sense of... In the way that Farley's book dipped back into childhood and some of your
Oh, yeah, Farley, well, Tatty was. Tatty
moved into your own childhood as well.
Yeah, Tatty was easy in a sense that it was very much... I was able to use myself and my own circumstances and my own childhood, and I was able to refer to that. But it was difficult to write because it was a very personal book.
Yeah.
This one, but there's plenty of me in Farley too.
Of course, yeah.
And I always think, and I presume other writers do too, that writing and acting are very similar type of things. And I would probably prefer to be an actress, but I just wouldn't have the battle to do it, you know, or the discipline. You pretend to be somebody else. So I pretended to be Farley during the time when I was writing it. And his age changes almost, you know, every chapter by 10 years. So you kind of, that gave it a little bit more scope that you could just sort of remember what it was like to be that age. But then you had to change your gender while you were at it, you know.
And it's a wonderful concept, you know, notion of man going backwards in age. And
yeah.
I mean, the way I used to write novels is that I'd be walking my dog at night and it would occur to me that I dismissed as the most ludicrous, stupid, unimaginable idea.
Yeah.
And that's the one that I'd write about 2 years later.
That's right, that happens.
What did Farley come to you as a character, or did the notion of a man moving back in time come first?
Farley started life as a short story.
Yeah.
The first chapter was actually a short story that I'd written. Mm-hmm. And I was writing, the previous novel had been Last Train from Liguria, which was a two-country thing, Italy and Ireland and London. And it was a very big book to write, and... It took a long time to write, and a lot of work involved. But I'd happened to write this short story called The Fly Fisher, which was just there. I then started to write a book about a fella coming back from India to Ballyferm after 20 years, just at the beginning of this recession, when we were all moaning and groaning about everything. And he was coming back to his father's funeral. And it was going okay, and I had a good whack of it written, like, you know. So, but there was something about this man lying on the floor of the Jacks in Ballyferm that I just couldn't get out of my head.
Yeah.
But then I thought, I don't want to do the two country things again. I'd been to India, I'd have to go back. I wasn't very well. I was kind of confined to barracks during the writing of it. So I said, you know, to hell with it, I'm going to go back and look at that short story again. And I just, as it happened, Joseph O'Connor was doing the favourite book of short stories then.
Yeah.
And he got in touch, and I was just about to give him the Farley one, the Fly Fisher. And then I said, no, I'm not giving it. So I took the first section of the Ballyfermot at India thing and whacked that around and chopped it up and did this, that and the other and gave him that instead and called it absence. And then I only had, the only thing I had to work on then was the fly fisher. So I began, I didn't know where I was going, what was going to happen. Towards the end of that short story and first chapter, there's a little section where, the very end of it, he knows he's been to the dry cleaners, he knows he's left a suit in to be cleaned, he can't remember why, and he's trying to remember which suit it was. And that's when I said, right, that's what I'll start the next day with, him leaving the suit in. And then when I got to the end of that chapter, I said, I'll do the day he retires now. And I just kind of knew then by chapter three I was going backwards every 10 years.
And was that fascinating for you? Because I think there's a great danger for a writer of getting too far ahead of yourself the book, of knowing where you're going. And some of this was, it was a great advantage to you actually to almost begin sideways and actually sort of... when you went to your desk in the morning, you weren't quite sure where this book was going to go.
And if I started a new chapter, what I did was, the research was very minimal and it's all I had to do was... If I started a new chapter and it was the 5th of June, I would just get online, because I couldn't really go out. I'd get online to, say, the Irish Times for that day, the 5th of June, 1965, whatever it was, and I'd just drop him into that day and see what we do with him, what happened to him. So I didn't overthink it. Sometimes I think we tend to overthink what we've to do. Yeah. I didn't overthink it. I just said, I didn't show it to anyone, which is unusual. I usually show it to my agent and to my husband, Dennis. Just kept going, and I just said, don't look left, don't look right, don't look behind you, just keep moving, you know. So that's what I did.
Is that one of them you'd advise in the sense of that people are inclined to sense themselves or worry much about where they're going? If you're on a roll, to just go with it and then worry about it when it's on the page.
Yeah, that's what they mean by developing. I think an awful lot of people want to know what the book is about, but then what will I do and how is it going to end? And they're worried about that. But personally, I always start with the character. And I think if you start with the character and you get physically and mentally and emotionally inside your character, that the character will take care of things themselves.
And then the difference of writing about in something like Tatty, something that was actually much, much closer to home, was that harder to do in many ways? When you change gender and you change age, you sort of float yourself free of that thing of how will people judge me or how will people look at me, everything else. When you're writing something that is very much, that has its origins in very personal things, is that a more difficult task?
It is more difficult. It was difficult when I was writing because I knew I was going to get a hard time over it. And I did, but what could I do? It's done. And probably Tatty, I think if I had time to think about it again and if I had the choice again, I probably wouldn't write it, not yet anyway. But at that stage in my life, I needed to make sense of things, and I think that's why I wrote it. And I just wrote this story about a little girl and about how her perception of her parents' marriage breakup and the breakup of their marriage changes as she gets a little bit older, and it was quite difficult. It's a short book, but it took me a long time to do it.
But also it got a huge public reception. Did you find that people wrote to you and said, this makes sense of my life as well?
Yeah, it did, and there was a danger too then if people wanted me sort of to almost become the spokesperson for the adult child of alcoholics, you know, which I didn't want to do either. But a lot of people did write and say, you know, that it spoke to them and it was a subject that was never discussed, and it made them feel better and all that sort of stuff. But I don't know. It did seem to make a difference to people. And people are always saying that alcoholism is an illness, but it's not like an illness because you're not allowed to talk about it. Only the alcoholic can, but the other people around can't talk about it.
I understand the point of not becoming a spokesman.
People
imagine that writers know more than they actually do know.
Only talking about your own thing. And I remember coming back from India and being kind of very tired and not knowing what I was at and being asked to come on to a television thing. And you do things sometimes, I don't know, you do things sometimes just because you're asked without thinking it through. And I went on this David McWilliams program, wondering, why am I here? There's loads of people here. What am I doing here anyway? And he suddenly said my name out and he said, your parents were alcoholics, Christine. What was that like? And I nearly died. I just didn't know how to get out of it. I just didn't know what to do. I mean, you're on live television, which I had no experience of anyway. So I just thought, no, I'm just going underground now. I'm not going to talk about anything like this.
And that's the advantage of being a fiction writer. Then you can go on. You may obliquely come back to it and address some of those themes.
I do, yeah.
You can do it behind the thing. But at the same time, if these are the things that shape your life, then as a writer, you always find that they're almost like the way that water creeps through walls, that those underlying things that actually shape us and that they shape our childhoods are the things that books are totally different, you know.
Yeah. Like even the beginning with Farley, I was thinking about my own father, but he died when he was 73, and his pals and the kind of what they were like, and you know, we are very much. I think the childhood is the really big thing with the writer.
And have you a favourite of all your novels?
Favourite, Farley. I think at the moment, yeah.
The Cold Eye of Heaven.
The Cold Eye of Heaven. Very. I kind of really took to the character when I was writing it, and I felt I really knew him at the end of it.
And Dave McWilliams hasn't invited you on to talk about 75-year-old men as a spokesman, no?
No, well, I would love to do that. Yeah, that'd be great. Why someone get me into trouble, you know? I was at an interview once, and somebody asked me why did I start. But of course, he's only 75 or two chapters. Mm-hmm. But I'd said I kind of always like Alfred. I always had a soft spot for the man. A woman came up to me later and said, "I don't keep my husband away from you anyway."
Can I ask you something? Would you tell us about Patrick Kavanagh and the Rosebushes?
And the wee and the Rosebushes. Yeah, well, my father was very friendly with... Both my parents were very friendly with Patrick Kavanagh, and he was sort of part of the scene when we were kids. We had pretty difficult neighbours too, and they were a retired couple, and they had a beautiful rose garden, and they wanted to keep everything very nice. They certainly didn't want to be living beside hooligans like the likes of us. But anyway, I had a cousin who was sort of very delicate and dainty, and we were playing ball in the garden, and the ball went over the wall, and she hopped over it, and as she was coming back, the man, we won't name him, smacked her. And my mother was distraught about this. They were coming home from an early Sunday morning session, and wherever it was, MacDade's or wherever they were. And she was telling Kavanagh, he was in the car like that, you know. When we were kids, he was like this exotic thing, a toy that came into the house that talked to itself and would throw tissues on the ground and fall asleep on the floor and, you know, like, and talk, you know, the talking, making all these hockey noises all the time. And so anyway, he was in the car and he was, "Oh dear, oh dear, oh dear, oh dear, oh dear, all your tears," this, and there was about 100 of us squashed into the back of the car, you know. And of course, the drink and driving thing didn't come into it at all. They were driving home. And my mother's going on about your woman next door, you know, and the people next door and the whole lot. And he didn't say anything. He didn't sort of say, "Oh, that's terrible," and kept quiet. So she sort of went quiet, and I presume she thought he wasn't that impressed by it or he didn't care. And he got out of the car, pulled down the fly and pissed all over the roses. This is on a Sunday afternoon. It's a beautiful summer Sunday afternoon. That was the end of that. Oh God, we just thought he was brilliant after that. Really, roses. That's all, you know.
And what are you working on a new book?
I started a new book. I have a title. The title is The Lives of Women. Mm-hmm. And of course, other people talk about they have the blank page. My problem is I have three beginnings now, and I don't know which one to pick. Mm-hmm. I'm at that stage where I'm just kind of prancing, prowling around the cage, and we'll see what happens. I have ideas, but I'm not set on them yet.
And what's the most exciting part of the novel for you? When you're a novel, I mean, is it that stage when you're prowling around?
I hate that. It's the day you know that it's caught. You know, if you're throwing yourself at those gooey things that you throw at the wall and you stick, and you know you're on track. That to me is when I have something, and I'm delighted with that.
Yeah.
But I mean, I don't think I'm finished with Farley yet because it's been optioned for film. It might happen, and apparently 9 times out of 10, you'd know better than I do. Probably
this has been optioned for film.
Yeah, and which I would never have thought.
Is Mel Street playing Farley?
I think so. Yeah, I was going to ask you. In his younger years,
I don't know if I could age down enough. You know?
I know. You know the Butlin scene when he's doing the twist and all that.
My acting skills and Meryl Streep's hips, I could do it. No problem whatsoever.
That,
you know, it would be easy to walk through. You know, it's been wonderful to see these books emerge over the years and see them receive the recognition that they actually deserve. Thank you, Christine Dwyer Hickey.
You've been listening to The Red Line Readings, a Curious Broadcast production in partnership with South Dublin Libraries. Red Line Readings was part of South Dublin Libraries' Red Line Book Festival and was curated by writer Dermot Bulger. You can podcast this programme on southdublinlibraries.com and on curiousbroadcast.com. Red Line Readings was made with the support of Sound and Vision, a Broadcasting Authority of Ireland fund.